The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mark Newman from the Triangle Radio Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I shall share with you information from various medical sources. From the People's Pharmacy, King Features, Syndicate. Getting off Effexor proves challenging. Question. I tried to get off Effexor XR, then Lathoxine, a few years ago, and the results were typical. Agony, muscle aches, brain zaps, and a depression worse than I had before starting on the drug. 6 months ago, thinking I had learned from experience, I crafted a foolproof plan. I reduced super gradually, counting little beads inside the capsule. At first, this went well. I was so proud of myself. Finally, I was down to 5 of those little beads. Then I got a horrible dizzy spell, and soon I slid down the rabbit hole again, just as if I had stopped suddenly. After suffering for 2 weeks, I called the prescriber. The first time he had told me I was being a hypochondriac. This time he told me that some people can never quit Effexor. I wanted to smack him. Instead, I started taking half the regular dose. I was literally hooked. Will I be forced to take this for the rest of my life? Answer. Your doctor, like many others, should take antidepressant withdrawal therapy very seriously. A recent article in The Lancet Psychiatry online, March 5, 2019, points out that the symptoms can be severe. The author suggests that drugs such as sertraline, which is Zoloft, and paroxetine, which is Paxil, should be tapered very gradually. The smaller the dose, the smaller and slower the reduction. It may take many months or even years to get off the drug completely. We suspect that this also would help with your withdrawal from Effexor, a similar antidepressant. Some people remove just one bead every few weeks as they get closer to weaning off completely. You may wish to look for a doctor who can help you with this instead of telling you it's impossible. Question. I've been taking lisinopril for many years. I know one of the side effects is a dry cough, but I never had the problem. Suddenly, now I do. Has this drug been reformulated? My cough is intense, and my throat has been very dry for the past several months. I plan to discuss this with my cardiologist. Answer. Some people develop a troublesome cough within several weeks of starting on an ACE inhibitor blood pressure pill like lisinopril. Others, however, may not start coughing for months or even years, and that's cited in the European Journal of Internal Medicine, January 2017. Sometimes this delay leads to misdiagnosis. Does nitric oxide really lower blood pressure? Question. Recently, I read that nitric oxide might be useful for high blood pressure and other ailments. Does nitric oxide really help lower blood pressure? If so, how much of the supplement should a person with high blood pressure take each day? If it works, a lot of people could benefit from the supplement. The source stated that leafy dark greens and beetroots are natural sources for nitric oxide. Answer. Green leafy vegetables and beets supply dietary nitrate. In the body, this is converted to nitric oxide, which relaxes blood vessels and lowers blood pressure. And that's cited in Nutrition Research Reviews, December 2017. A study in healthy older people demonstrated that consuming beet juice rich in nitrates lowered blood pressure, reduced the clotting activity of blood, and had anti-inflammatory properties. And that's cited in Nutrients, November 22, 2017. We are not aware of studies utilizing nitric oxide as a dietary supplement. Question. In recent articles, you have addressed nasal issues concerning or causing painful sinuses and facial discomfort. Years ago, I used to wake up every morning with face aches, a.k.a. sinus pain. I went to different doctors who prescribed sulfa until I became allergic to it. Then I read an article that said many sinus issues are caused by an allergy to the milk protein casein. I stopped drinking milk and have never had the face aches again. I use unsweetened almond milk for my morning oatmeal and all is good. Answer. There is a popular belief that consuming dairy products can contribute to nasal congestion. We have struggled to find research confirming this connection. We think, however, that people suffering with ongoing sinusitis might want to try switching to non-dairy beverages and foods as an experiment. A recent review demonstrates that more than 10% of U.S. adults have food allergies, with shellfish and milk most common. That's cited in JAMA Network Open, January 4, 2019. People who suspect an allergy would do well to see a doctor about allergy testing. And from the New York Times, procedure may replace open-heart surgery for many. The operation is a daring one, to replace a failing heart valve. Cardiologists insert a mechanical replacement through a patient's groin and thread it all the way to the heart, maneuvering it into the site of the old valve. The procedure, called transcatheter aortic valve replacement, has been reserved mostly for patients so old and sick they might not survive open-heart surgery. Now, two large clinical trials show that TAVR is just as useful in younger, healthier patients. It might even be better, offering lower risks of disabling strokes and death compared to open-heart surgery. Cardiologists say it will likely change the standard of care for most patients with failing aortic valves. How, or is it important? Heck yes, says Dr. Robert Letterman, who directs the Interventional Cardiology Research Program at the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute. The findings were remarkable, he added. Letterman was not involved with the studies and does not consult for the two device companies that sponsored them. In open-heart surgery, a patient's ribs are cracked apart and the heart is stopped to insert the new aortic valve. With TAVR, the only incision is a small hole in the groin where the catheter is inserted. Most patients are sedated but awake through the procedure, and recovery takes just days, not months, as is often the case following the usual surgery. The results shift our thinking from asking who should get TAVR to why should anyone get surgery, says Dr. Howard Herman, director of interventional cardiology at the University of Pennsylvania. The studies are to be published in the New England Journal of Medicine and presented at the American College of Cardiology's annual meeting. The Food and Drug Administration is expected to approve the procedure for lower-risk patients. As many as 20,000 patients a year would be eligible for TAVR, in addition to the nearly 60,000 intermediate and high-risk patients who get the operation now. This is a clear win for TAVR, said Dr. Michael J. Mack, a heart surgeon at Baylor Scott and White, the Heart Hospital, Plano, in Texas. From now on, we will be very selective about who gets open-heart surgery, and Mack, is a principal investigator in one of the trials. Some healthier patients will still need the traditional surgery. For example, those born with two flaps in the aortic valve instead of the usual three. Having two flaps can lead to early aortic valve failure. Aortic valve failure stems from a stiffening of the valve controlling flow from the large vessel in the heart that supplies blood to the rest of the body. Patients often are tired and short of breath. There is no way to prevent the condition and no treatment other than replacing the valve. The main risk factor is advancing age. The study led by Mack and Dr. Martin Leon, an interventional cardiologist at Columbia University in New York, tracked deaths, disabling strokes, and hospitalizations at 1 year following the procedures. The rates were 15% with surgery versus 8.5% with TAVR. The rates of deaths and disabling strokes, the factors most important to patients, were 2.9% with surgery versus 1% with TAVR. The second study estimated deaths or disabling strokes at 2 years, finding rates of 6.7% with surgery versus 5.3% with TAVR. The trials were sponsored by the makers of TAVR valves, Edwards Life Sciences of Irvine, California, and Medtronic, headquartered in Dublin. The two companies make slightly different valves. Dr. Jeffrey Popma, an interventional cardiologist at Beth Israel Deaconess in Boston, led the second trial and is a consultant for both manufacturers. He uses both devices in surgery and said the important finding is that both were preferable to surgery. For Robert Pettinato, 79, a retiree in Scranton, Pennsylvania, there was no question. He had been feeling mild chest pain, and he was finding it difficult to finish a round of golf. But last year, when his cardiologist told Pettinato that he needed a new valve, the only way he could get TAVR was to enter a clinical trial. He enrolled in the Edwards trial at the University of Pennsylvania. He had a TAVR in November, stayed in the hospital for 24 hours, and went home. A few days later, he went to the football game at Lehigh University against his arch rival Lafayette. Shortly afterward, his younger brother Jim, who lives in Florida, had to have aortic valve replacement. He wanted TAVR, but the clinical trials were closed. He had surgery instead. Took his brother 4 months to recover enough to play a round of golf, Pettinato said. From the Wall Street Journal, Healthcare Technology, a new prognosis for pain care. Innovative ways to measure, understand, and treat pain are allowing doctors to ease patient suffering without relying on potentially dangerous drugs. By Laura Landro. A new world of pain treatment is on the horizon. Advances in measuring pain could show doctors how much pain the patient feels more vividly and help them dial the treatment up or down more precisely. Better ability to assess each patient's risk for chronic pain, including identifying the genes that make it more likely, could lead to more personalized and effective treatments, and a deeper understanding of pain's causes and new methods to treat it are starting to improve doctors' ability to ease pain without relying on potentially dangerous and addictive drugs. The need has never been more urgent. More than 50 million adults in the U.S. are living with chronic pain at an estimated annual cost of $560 billion in medical care, lost productivity, and disability programs, according to federal data. Unlike acute pain, the sharp, instantaneous sensation that alerts the body to injury or trauma, chronic pain can persist long after normal healing, lasting for months or years. Lower back pain and migraines are among the most common complaints, but chronic pain can affect any part of the body, drastically limit activity, and lead to hopelessness and depression. With few tools to understand what each patient is feeling and why, doctors have often turned to a blunt, one-size-fits-all treatment. Prescription opioids, which can be effective in treating acute pain after surgery or in the advanced stages of cancer. But there is scant evidence that opioids are effective for chronic long-term pain outside of end-of-life care, and the sharp rise in opioid prescriptions after 1999 contributed to an epidemic of overdoses and deaths. In 2016, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recommended against opioids as first-line treatment of chronic pain, and doctors have become more cautious, leading to a decline in prescribing rates. Here are some of the advances that are improving the understanding of pain and medicine's ability to treat it. How much does it hurt? For decades, doctors have used a simple 1 to 10 numerical scale and a range of smiley or frowning faces to assess how much pain a patient is feeling. Now researchers are developing objective measures for pain by monitoring how the brain reacts to it. This can allow doctors to determine how much pain a patient is feeling when the patient can't communicate, such as infants or Alzheimer's sufferers. It can also help doctors predict how patients will react to certain medications or procedures, which can make treatments more effective and aid in the development of new drugs. In a test at Stanford University, volunteers were touched with prods that caused pain or ones that didn't, and the brain activity was tracked with a non-invasive imaging system. Using an algorithm that detects patterns in brain activity, researchers could distinguish between painful and non-painful stimuli more than 80% of the time. Sean Mackey, Chief of the Division of Pain Medicine and Director of the Neuroscience and Pain Lab at Stanford, says the real benefit to using brain scans may be in helping to test the effectiveness of new drugs or procedures. Artificial intelligence can take data from brain imaging and use it to make predictions about how patients will respond to treatment. His group has developed technology to image the entire central nervous system from the spinal cord to the brain to better predict treatment response and whether someone with chronic pain will improve or worsen. If we had a way to use brain activity to predict the response to treatment, that is at the heart of precision medicine, Dr. Mackey says. He warns, however, there are ethical issues to be resolved, such as whether brain scans could be used to deny treatment to patients if they don't confirm the patient's own description of pain. Another area of research involves measuring theta waves, a type of brain activity. A study by researchers at Brown University in November found that measuring the power of theta waves in animals using electroencephalographs, a process involving electrodes attached to the scalp, is an effective and direct test of pain as well as the performance of pain medication. Study co-author Carl Saab, director of the Center for Pain and Neural Circuits at Brown University in Rhode Island Hospital, says that in humans, pain is more complicated. But by combining theta wave data and other information, artificial intelligence can develop algorithms for measuring pain and identifying pain types. The algorithms can accurately predict pain scores on the numerical and smiley face pain scales used in clinics and emergency departments, Dr. Saab says. Using algorithms could eventually help patients convey their pain level with more accuracy and assist the doctor in reaching an objective pain diagnosis, he says. This could lead doctors to prescribe fewer opioids, lowering the risk of addictions, and lead to better health outcomes. Where does the pain come from? Researchers developing assessments to provide a fuller picture of how pain affects a patient's life. That has significant consequences for treatment. So doctors are starting to examine how a patient's other psychological and physical conditions can change the subjective experience of pain, such as how pain can be amplified by depression and anxiety. At the University of Washington Center for Pain Relief in Seattle, researchers developed an online assessment called Pain Tracker, where patients answer questions to determine what impact pain has on their lives. One aim is to help them better understand their condition and manage their recovery. Questions involve not just pain intensity, but issues involving difficulty with sleep, mood, appetite, and performing daily activities. An evaluation of data from over 4,000 patients found that a substantial number were struggling with depression, anxiety, and post-traumatic stress disorder, and were severely disabled or worse. Many were at moderate to severe risk of opioid misuse. Learning about such issues through the pain tracker assessments can help busy doctors evaluate the patient's pain experience and help steer them to the most effective treatments, the researchers say. Many patients with chronic pain get hunkered down into this chronic crisis mode where they're just thinking about surviving into the next day, says Mark Sullivan, a co-author of the study and professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences. He says the assessments help doctors steer patients to interventions that have been shown to help manage pain. Using genetics to understand and treat pain, studies have shown that family history and shared genetic risk factors can play a role in the development of chronic pain. Understanding those risk factors and identifying people who have them could let doctors optimize treatments for those patients and give them a better shot at recovery. At the University of North Carolina, researchers have found that people with certain genetic variants are more likely to have chronic pain after exposure to trauma, such as sexual assault and motor vehicle crashes. in a study of 1,500 blood samples of people who had experienced motor vehicle trauma, published last year in the Journal of Neuroscience, the researchers found that those with the risk variant had impaired ability to regulate the stress hormone cortisol, and thus are more likely to experience chronic pain than people without the variant. The finding helps us understand why some people develop chronic pain after trauma and others do not, and also helped us identify a possible novel target for drug discovery, says lead study author Sarah Lenstadt, an assistant professor of anesthesiology and investigator at UNC's Institute for Trauma Recovery. The goal is to develop a therapy that could help the body control cortisol levels after trauma exposure. Dr. Lenstadt's lab is also investigating the role of sex hormones in driving increased chronic pain after trauma exposure in women. At St. Louis University, Daniela Salvermini, director of its Center for Neuroscience and professor of pharmacology and physiology, discovered pain pathways that are dependent on two particular molecules. In animal studies, scientists have been able to block or reverse pain with drugs that targeted these molecules. Dr. Salvermini is now investigating whether these molecules can serve as biomarkers, measures of biological processes or interventions for pain associated with a number of health conditions. If so, doctors can optimize treatments for specific groups of patients that have those biomarkers. Not everyone develops pain in the same manner or responds to drugs in the same manner, so the goal is to select patients who might be the best candidates for a drug, Dr. Salvermini says. Going directly to the brain. To replace the need for drugs that can lead to addiction, researchers and device companies are also making advances in neuromodulation. The use of technologies such as surgically implanted spinal cord stimulators to interrupt pain signals with electrical pulses to the brain. A new spinal cord stimulator from Boston Scientific called the Spectra WaveWriter SCS system allows patients to control how much of a sensation they feel in areas with pain. Malik Nanavati, president of the Neuromodulation Division, says that this choice allows doctors and patients to deliver therapy most comfortable to them and help with chronic pain from failed back surgery and other intractable pain conditions. Jim Davis, a retired Marine in North Carolina, had one of these devices implanted last August. Mr. Davis, 48, suffering chronic back pain after a truck accident, tried a number of other options, including back surgeries and alternative therapies, but the pain returned. Prescription opioids weren't even taking the edge off, and I was more stoned than relieved of pain. Neuropathy in his feet made it impossible to walk, and he even considered having both amputated. The Boston Scientific device, he says, has allowed him to stop using a wheelchair and start swimming and scuba diving. He tweaks his setting on the device so he doesn't have sensations at night because it's easier to sleep without it. He sometimes turns it off for 20 minutes at a time. I'm not worried anymore about not being near my morphine pump or leaving my house without my pain pills, Mr. Davis says. Researchers are also testing neurostimulation approaches that don't require surgery or implanted devices. Flavio Froelich, director of the Carolina Center for Neurostimulation and associate professor of psychiatry at the University of North Carolina, says that chronic pain disrupts normal patterns of brain activity in regions associated with pain, so you get a persistent pain signal to the brain. With a treatment known as transcranial alternating current stimulation, Dr. Froelich and other researchers delivered weak alternating currents of electricity imperceptible to study subjects through electrodes on the scalp. In a study published in November in the Journal of Pain, they showed that by targeting one brain region, they could enhance natural brain rhythms known as alpha oscillations and significantly decrease symptoms of lower back pain in just one session. And then finally, a holistic approach to pain. Some pain medicine experts are returning to an idea originally conceived in the 1970s, combining modern technology with holistic approaches. According to the National Institutes of Health, a growing body of evidence suggests approaches such as acupuncture, hypnosis, mindfulness, meditation, spinal manipulation, and yoga may help to manage chronic pain. Research also supports cognitive behavior therapy, which teaches patients skills to overcome negative thoughts and behaviors at a cost-effective way to manage some chronic pain. The National Institutes of Health last year doubled its budget for pain and addiction research to $1.1 billion. In addition to research on non-addictive pain medicines and new biomarkers that might predict who is more likely to transition from acute to chronic pain, it is funding studies to identify the most effective non-drug and integrated therapies for specific pain conditions. There are appropriate uses for opioids for pain management, but the risks when they are used over the long term have to be balanced with the benefits, says Linda L. Porter, director of the Office of Pain Policy at the National Institute for Neurological Disorders and Stroke, part of the NIH. We need to offer people with chronic pain something else because they are desperate to get better and get back to their lives. Second opinion from the Mayo Clinic Health Letter. My eye doctor asked if I'm ready to have my cataracts removed. They're not bothering me too much. Is it a good idea to just get it done? In general, if your vision isn't bothersome, there's no harm in putting off cataract surgery. But if you begin the struggle, there are numerous benefits to having the procedure done. A cataract occurs when the naturally clear lens inside your eye becomes cloudy. Having cataracts is like looking through a dirty or foggy windshield. You may still be able to drive, but the more compromised your view is, the greater your risk of an accident. The same is true with cataracts. A 2018 study of people with cataracts in both eyes found that participants who had surgery on one eye reduced their risk of car crashes by 61% compared with the year before the procedure. Car accidents aren't the only risk. Research shows that cataracts increase the risk of falls. Surgery improves clarity, color perception, and brightness, and helps with night vision. My husband has cognitive decline that's worsening. He also loves his firearm collection. Should I be concerned? Answer, yes, you have reason to be concerned. Having firearms becomes increasingly risky as mild cognitive impairment slides into more severe dementia or Alzheimer's. Risks include suicide, harm to others, harm to themselves. If a loved one refuses to give up firearms, the conversation becomes more difficult. You may need to reach out to family members, friends, or a doctor to help persuade your loved one to remove weapons. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues, but be sure to listen at the same time next week. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Mark Newman, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time. If you have any comment or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138 and stay healthy.